Call to order the meeting of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Roll.
Representative Shemansky.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel.
Here.
Representative Lane. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Shoemaker. Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Here.
Representative Wardlow.
Present.
Quorum is present. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes of our meeting of March 8th?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. And welcome Representative Shemansky on House File Number 2531.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, last week we laid this bill over for further work. Today I bring it back. We are working, on House File 2531 from the A2 Amendment. But this morning, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the adoption of the A4 Amendment.
Okay. Would you like to move the bill, Representative Shemansky?
Great. Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 2531 be considered for passage and sent to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, and I believe as
amended.
As amended with A2. Okay. Your motion for Amendment A4?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt the A4 amendment to House File 2531. But I'm sure we'll need to discuss it before we can pass it further. So, Mr. Chairman, today, following last week's testimony, we've done a little more work on this bill and brought forward the A4 amendment to answer some of the concerns that we heard in last week's presentation on this bill. But just for a little background, Minnesota has had a voluntary parenting plan since the year 2000. The purpose of this bill is to encourage people to develop their own parenting plan. Judges would not have to take time in the courtroom to help develop this parenting plan if it was done prior to the court appearance. The bill requires the parties to attend 2 hours of mediation to develop that said parenting plan. Many courts, such as the Court of Appeals and the civil courts, already require parties to use mediation. The mediation is required before you can go to the Court of Appeals for family law cases. 36% of the time those cases are settled in mediation. There are many benefits of having a parenting plan instead of the current court process. We anticipate it should be less adversarial, less conflict for the children involved, less burden on the courts, freeing up some court time, hopefully saving some of the revenue or expenditures of the court. We also anticipate we would have better outcomes for the parents in this plan and better compliance with the terms of the divorce overall. So a fiscal note has been requested on this bill, Mr. Chairman, and if the bill does receive a fiscal note and after it's been sent to civil law, we would anticipate the bill would come back to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Shemansky. Do you have testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll let our testifier introduce himself.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Steve Erickson. Good morning, members of the committee and Mr. Chair. A pleasure to be here. I'm pleased to be invited to testify on this.
Okay. Go ahead with your testimony.
Well, I did testify last week, and I simply wanted to draw a distinction for the court on the difference between parenting plans and seeking custody. And the purpose of this two-hour mediation bill is designed to encourage people to develop a parenting plan, and a parenting plan is based upon the self-determination of the parties. An early neutral evaluation is certainly a device that has been used by the courts here and around the country, but it's primarily a device that attempts to predict outcomes in court. And generally, the outcomes that are evaluated are whether or not the parties will prevail on a custody request. And an early neutral evaluation is basically submitting the case to a person who makes a recommendation to the parties that is based upon likely outcomes in court. And likely outcomes in court under our law are generally limited to courts deciding sole custody or joint custody or so forth. A parenting plan is built by the parties, and so a parenting plan is based on the self-determination of the parties, and the mediator's skills are very different. The mediator's skills try to help the parties cooperate. The early neutral evaluator is generally an attorney or a court services custody evaluator, and those skills relate to predicting outcomes generally in court. And so there's a very distinct difference, and it's our hope that as parties are encouraged to mediate, they will not end up in court. They'll not need early neutral evaluators. They'll figure it out themselves with the help of the mediators who are skilled in helping them build parenting plans.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Representative Szymanski.
All right. Let me just see if Mr. Hattie would like to testify.
Representative Szymanski, before we go to the next witness, we do have a question. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Erickson, I have a question. Thank you.
Yes.
Just so the members know, I actually took Mr. Erickson and Mrs. Erickson's class on mediation while I was a student at William Mitchell College of Law, and it was very good. And I like mediation, and I actually got the certification that they give for completing the class. Can I ask, why is it that you think that mediation should be mandated even in areas where they're having great success with the processes that they're working on? I mean, this is saying that this process should replace the other processes that the court is doing, or they should do this first, even if they're already having great success in some of the other programming. Why do you think we should do that?
Well, I think because the logical progression is that parties are encouraged to make their own decisions first. The success that the court is having, it may be an improvement over a full-scale trial or a six-month custody investigation, but the early neutral evaluation process has only been around for the last 5 or 6 years as it's been applied to family law. It was developed in the late 80s in the Northern District of California as a device to evaluate complex lawsuits involving patents and Silicon Valley engineering cases. Certainly the court can ask people to advise it and to make expert evaluations, but I think that the mediation requirement is not attempting to replace anything. It's attempting to give people an opportunity to first see if they can do it on their own. If they just go directly to early neutral evaluations, they tend to get locked into positions. They tend to be focusing then on the contest because they generally have to have their attorneys. And I have not conducted an early neutral evaluation, but I'm told that most of the time the attorneys have to be present at an early neutral evaluation. And so my belief is that the parenting plan policy of this case, this state, to encourage the use of parenting plans, which are less adversarial, less burdens on the court, better outcomes for the court, are more likely to be achieved if the parties are assisted with a mediator in the beginning rather than going right into having an evaluator hear their request as to what should happen in court. They're very different. One's adjudicative and the other is cooperative and mediative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, so if a couple is trying to work it out prior to filing for divorce and for custody, and maybe they've done some different counseling or different mediation services prior to actual filing for divorce, should they have to do it again?
Well, if they have a settlement, they shouldn't have, I mean, if they've worked things out, they shouldn't have to go to either mediation or to early neutral evaluation. They can just file their document with the court.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hillstrom.
The question wasn't have question. They worked it out. The question was if they've already done it prior to filing for divorce.
If they've already,
right?
done,
they've already done counseling, yeah. They've already attempted some form of mediation, yeah. Or some alternative form of trying to work it out. If they've already tried that prior to filing for divorce, should they be mandated by the state to do it again?
Mr. Erickson.
I think certainly if they've been to mediation and reached impasse, their next step should be to court. I wouldn't object to an amendment to the bill that perhaps said if the parties can certify that they've made a good faith effort in mediation, not just say, well, we've had discussions, but they've actually worked with a mediator, perhaps a Rule 114 mediator. I don't know that they should be forced to do it again if they've done it once. We're simply trying to catch, I think, those people who have never experienced mediation and saying that there's a preference in favor of encouraging parties to build parenting plans, and if they're going to build parenting plans, they need the help of a mediator, not an evaluator as to custody. So,
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I learned very well in your class that mediation is voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that we should then mandate it and make it no longer about voluntary?
Mr. Erickson.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, we have a history of mandating people to sit down in the room, as in the Farmer Lender Mediation Act in 1985. Around the country, most jurisdictions have some form of mandatory or at least strong encouragement of mediation. I'm told that the early neutral evaluation is not mandatory in all cases, but it's strongly urged on the parties. And I think that making the two-hour mediation session mandatory, the state is making a public policy in favor of saying, we expect that you should cooperate around your children. We're not mandating you to mediate child support, property division, or anything else. It's tied to the parenting plans, and we would like you to mediate that first because we feel that that's so important for families. And I think that once people are in the mediation room, they can see whether or not it's working. Many times they might choose to go longer than 2 hours, but if it does not work, at least there's been an opportunity to see if the children and the parties on their own can reach an agreement. So I used to be opposed to mandatory mediation because the key principle of mediation is the self-determination of the parties. And as I've done research preparing for this, I've noticed that in Tennessee, there's a requirement that you must attend 4 hours of mandatory mediation, and there really are very limited exceptions. And let me just correct one other thing that you mentioned earlier in your first question to me, Representative Hillstrom. The early neutral evaluation process, to my understanding, there's not any research that's been conducted regarding the client satisfaction or its with control groups, returns to court, and post-decree resolutions. It's been in use in Hennepin County in the last 5 or 6 years, and it's been expanded around the state. So I'm not aware of any research, and if there is some, I'd be interested in seeing it on its effectiveness.
Members and Representative Szymanski, we would like to, we have a long agenda, would like to get through this bill by 9 o'clock, so I'd ask that we have our testifiers in favor of this completed within the next 10 minutes and then give time to those who may be speaking against. And we do have a Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, after your indulgence,
Representative Szymanski,
would like to have a response to Representative Hillstrom's question.
On the previous question, yes. Mr. Hattie, please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Brad Hattie, H-A-D-D-Y, and I'm a practicing attorney, also practicing in the area of family law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom, also in answer to your question, your first question to Mr. Erickson, although he has stated some of the things that I would like to state regarding what is success and what statistical information we have, I think anyone that practices in the area will tell you that when there is a resolution, when there is a settlement of some sort, one of the first things that it says is that if the parties have a disagreement going forward, they must return to mediation. There is no further E&E process. Mediation is at the heart of resolving all of these issues of dispute, and that's one of the reasons why we believe that if it starts at that process, it has a greater chance, a greater opportunity for long-term success. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, just in response.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So if these people start in the mediation, then they have to come back to mediation. If they have success, they can't go to an early insurer. Is that what you just said?
No, that wasn't my point. My belief is that if they start in the field of mediation, that it's quite possible there would be a greater chance of success. We don't know the success of the E&E program. It is certainly probably successful from the standpoint of getting a resolution, but there are many disagreements that occur after an agreement has been reached. And every document in a court says that if there is a disagreement going forward, these parties must go to mediation to resolve it.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've talked to a number of people in my district now about this whole issue, and one of the things that came up is that in my district, and probably in many districts around the state, we have a lot of people with different cultural backgrounds. And actually, I was hoping to ask Mr. Erickson this question, too. We've changed testifiers here while we're still asking questions of the first one. One of the things that came up is that, for example, we have many people from cultures in which there's a huge power imbalance between the spouses. And in the culture, they are not accustomed to mediating or speaking to each other and working things out in the way that we might think. And so I guess the question I have for you is whether you believe that mediation works in every setting. Is this because the bill, I must tell you, is a one-size-fits-all bill. And so that's my question. Do you believe that it works in that every couple, except for these exceptions, limited exceptions that are on this amendment, every couple should have to do mediation first?
I believe that no system is perfect. When we're dealing with conflict resolution and we're dealing with high conflict, as divorce is, as family breakdown is, as separate parenting is, it seems to me that even when there are power differentials, mediators are trained and have been taught to try to assist in helping the parties overcome those power differentials. Certainly they're there. I have mediated cases where there's been cultural issues that relate to significant different viewpoints about the role of men and women in parenting. But it seems to me that we have a law in this state that says, as a general rule, even after the marriage dissolution or after the parties separate, both parents are encouraged to be involved. So at that critical time where they're getting divorced and there is some court intervention or some intervention by a professional, it seems to me more realistic and more desirable to try to begin to teach them cooperative skills as opposed to saying, you're going to have to decide a contest fairly quickly because that's the way we work this out. Somebody is going to prevail, somebody's not. Family law and parenting, it seems to me, is more of a long-term proposition. And children, I think, do better, and we have significant research that says children do better when the parents mediate. I believe that's because they're taught to overcome the power differentials. They're taught nothing is perfect. We'll never make everybody the perfect family. And in fact, the idea behind mediation is to say they should decide within the context of their cultural background and their family what is going to work for them. The bills that say we must have 50-50 or we must do this or that. It seems to me that what we're saying is let's try to, in the beginning, teach them some cooperative skills to help them overcome some of those difficulties that you mentioned. And some of those difficulties are significantly hard in, for both courts and mediators, but we're trying to do it in the context of cooperative skills, I think.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Erickson. And, you know, I can appreciate that in the ideal world, everybody would get together and work out their differences. That would be great. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. The question is whether this bill moves that forward or not by mandating this process as opposed to something more tailored where a court perhaps helps decide what kind of alternative dispute resolution would be most beneficial. But I just want to say that, you know, what the study that you mentioned, and I haven't read it and don't know exactly what it is, but I suspect that it might be confounded. If you're looking at people who do mediation do better, you know, people who can do mediation probably are going to do better. So, but anyway, I think maybe we should move on, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Champion.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And this is to Mr. Erickson. And maybe it's a compound notion that I'd like to put forward, and perhaps you would be able to answer. Mr. Erickson, I heard you say that this particular mediation process is not intended to replace anything. But I believe that it's clear that the law currently encourages parties to use alternative dispute resolutions. And this is a part of the notice requirement. When a party files, this information comes forward, and it talks about specifically that there's this option that's available. And further, the court may also require parties to participate in this ADR if there are issues around custody or if there's issues around, you know, a parenting plan. The whole idea is to get parties to get to a place where they can sit down with each other and talk about what's in the best interest of the children. Notwithstanding that they're in this, you know, court process. Why? Because after the process is done, they're still going to be parents. And so the law encourages that. And so so I'm a little concerned and would like for you to react to this, that even though you're saying that this particular mediation process is not intended to replace anything, but it requires the parties to do mediation even before they sit down and talk to the judge for an initial case management plan. So can you help me understand why this should be a requirement when we already have currently in law a mechanism that allows parties to sit down and talk if they agree?
Mr. Chairman, can I answer that question?
Representative Anderson, let the witness have an opportunity to answer first, and then we can call back on you.
My response to that is that under Rule 114, the parties sort of have a smorgasbord of things they can choose. This bill is prioritizing the role of mediation only with respect to parenting plans, and it's requiring parties to do mediation as an aid to building the parenting plans. If parties fail in mediation, reach impasse, they can still do a full-blown custody investigation. They can do litigation. The court can order them to do early neutral evaluation. This is not replacing that. This is prioritizing it as a first step.
But it appears, Mr. Chair, if I might follow up.
Representative Champion.
It appears that you are saying not only that is it a priority, but you're mandating that
yes.
The parties do it.
That's correct.
And if the whole idea of mediation and this whole process is to empower parents, it doesn't sound like to me that this bill empowers parents. It tells them what they have to do, notwithstanding if they don't want to do it or not.
To the contrary, it's only respectfully, in my opinion, it's only telling them to participate in mediation. And if they participate in the early neutral evaluation, somebody is telling them what the likely outcome in court would be. So it's a very
Mr.
different
Chair,
process. The two are different.
If I might just follow up with a couple more questions. But I heard you say, Mr. Erickson, and perhaps there's something wrong with my hearing this morning, but I thought I heard you say that you've never participated in early neutral evaluation.
That's correct.
But I hear you constantly referring to what that process is right. or is not. I want to really understand where you're getting your information in order to decide or to conclude what early neutral evaluation is and its effectiveness. Wouldn't you? So if you have never done it, and there's no empirical data from your vantage point in order to get some clarity as to whether it's effective or not, perhaps that the request should be of us is to say that we should put some resources behind figuring out exactly what the impact of early neutral evaluation, as opposed to saying, even though we don't know if it's effective or not, and even though it might be effective in some shape, form, or fashion, we're still saying that we should have mediation be the mandatory form of discussion as opposed to the process that's in place that could be working, but we don't have the empirical data in order to prove it one way or the other.
Mr. Erickson.
And I'm only getting my information from what I observe in the mediation room with attorneys who come in, with parties who have completed the early neutral evaluation process. I've also spoken to Daniel Bowling, who is the ADR supervisor for the District Court of the Northern District of California, and Judge Brazil of that court is the inventor of the early neutral evaluation process. And I discussed with him several years ago the fact that Hennepin County was beginning to experiment with early neutral evaluations in family law. And we had a discussion about whether that would work, whether it would apply. He wanted to know if there was any research as to its success. I can only say that from my experience, I label an adjudicatory process a process where somebody else decides for the people based upon presenting evidence or arguments or claims. And the early neutral evaluation is a shortened version of either a summary jury trial or a mini trial. It's a shortened version where people come and make their claim and ask the court or ask the early neutral evaluator to decide in their favor and make a recommendation. That's what the people tell me, and that's what Mr. Hattie testified to as his experience. I do not go into court anymore because I work as a mediator, and I know that the two processes are exceedingly different, and I do not intend to make judgments about what the court should or shouldn't do. This is a bill that encourages parties to build parenting plans. When they go to an early neutral evaluation, they are not told, here's what the parenting plan should be. They're generally told, this is what the outcome would likely be in court on your demands.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Erickson, I can sincerely appreciate your eloquence around this is a process that you have not participated in. As a person who has participated in the early neutral evaluation process, let me be clear, and it's going to lead to my last question. The parties are brought, well, first of all, I asked by the court, well, let me even start before then. At the initial case management, the judge sits down with the parties, not with the judge being on the bench, but the judge is sitting at a table just like this, talks to the parties about this process and how the judge believes it's important for the parties to decide these critical issues, because the judge really doesn't want to be the one to decide these critical issues, and talks about a number of options that they would have and that he or she encourages them to talk as parents to figure out what they should do about their children, parenting time, and how important it is for the development of a child for both parents to be as involved as possible. Judge then says, hey, we have this early neutral evaluation. We have mediation. Is there something that would work best for you all that you both could agree on? And the parties agree. So if they agree that they're going to do early neutral evaluation, what happens is they both go down. The attorneys are there to set up the appointment, and they set up the appointment, and they show up on the day that they're supposed to. When they show up, there's usually a gender balance, and the parties are there, and the parents are now encouraged to talk about their child. And before they get to a parenting plan, they ask them to put a picture of the child on the table, so that no matter what folks talk about, the first thing that they say is, this is about your child, not about us, not about you, but about your child. And so we would hope that everything that we discuss is in that vein. So with that being said, the parties come to some agreement. If they cannot, the only thing that the evaluator does is says to the court, they could not reach an agreement. Which leads to a question, my last question, which is what Representative Smith asked last week, but I didn't get a clear answer. Would you be so kind to tell me in dollars and cents, how much per hour does a mediator make if we are saying that the parties have to, if the parties are mandated to go to mediation? I would like to know what a mediator makes per hour so that we can get a sense of what would be the additional time and expense for the parties.
Well, just like with early neutral evaluators or with attorneys, there's no required established fee. Parties pay the early neutral evaluators for their time, and they pay mediators or they pay the attorneys who come to a court. Mediators here and myself, my mediation fees vary from as low as $20 an hour to $350 an hour. There are mediators that I've heard in Minneapolis charge $400 an hour, $600 an hour. But generally in the family area, the mediator's fees are commensurate with what the lawyer's fees are. I have a policy of reducing my fees if the parties are in bankruptcy or if the parties have attorneys whose fees are significantly lower than my normal hourly rate. And so I don't know that the cost of this process is going to significantly add to the whole process, because the hope is that by the parties starting in mediation, they would have a greater likelihood of achieving a resolution of the parenting plan than if they were brought to the courthouse, where they are sitting in the courtroom and are asked to work things out in the courtroom. Increasingly, courts are taking on some of the skills of mediators. That's good. I remember Sandy Keith, our former Chief Justice, said to me once that we mediators have significantly affected the way attorneys practice. And my hope would just be that we could coexist and not think of mediation as something that's trying to replace the authority of the court, but is to have the public policy of this state say, we want you to first try mediation.
Mr. Chairman?
Is this
can
directly
I answer some
to
of his questions?
Representative Anderson, is this
like
directly
to some of the questions that
Representative Anderson, is this directly to a question?
Yes, from Mr. Champion. I'd like to clarify some of his questions.
Representative Anderson.
This bill does not require the parties to go to mediation before going to court. If you look in item number C, they just have to complete the mediation within 30 days of the filing of the court. So if you have your ICMC hearing or your court hearing before 30 days, you will be going into court before you go to mediation. You can also, in item number 5, the parties can submit to the court. Wait. At the item number 6, line 1.19, the parties can also go in front of the court and request to be relieved from the mediation requirement. So if you've already completed mediation, you've already done mediation, just go to your ICMC or your first court hearing, tell the judge we've already completed the mediation, and then you will not be required to do it. And we also have changed the concerns for the domestic abuse people too, in item number 4, that if one party is concerned for his or her personal safety, they can opt out. So there's a lot of ways people can opt out of this mandatory mediation process. And also, it just means you have to do 2 hours of mediation before E&E. We're not getting rid of the E&E process at all with this bill. I had a parenting plan legislation bill, House File 292, that required mandatory mediation, and you guys all seem to support that bill, but it had a huge fiscal note. So since we weren't able to do mandatory mediation or parenting plans, we thought that the best way we could try and further the parenting plans and getting more people to do parenting plans would be to have them develop the plans in mediation, because the courts are not wanting to spend their time in helping the parties. So this is only a bill basically focusing on parenting plans, not on mediation. The goal of this bill is so people will try parenting plans. They're only required to go to 2 hours. There's many provisions in the bill to opt out of this requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, if your goal is to have parents come together and talk and come up with a parenting plan, it appears that the law is already, the process already allows for mediation to be an element that the parties can choose to do, which is a part of the alternative dispute resolution, which means that if you're saying that the initial case management plan is something, the initial case management conference happens, right, and the parties sit down, that's one of the things that the court talks about already. They say mediation, if you want to do mediation, or you can do early neutral evaluation. It allows the parties to be empowered in order for them to decide what they choose. But what you're asking the parties to do now, or what you're asking us to approve or pass through, is to say, no, it's going to be mandated for you all to choose mediation whether you want to or not. And that seems to suggest to me that we are not giving parties the freedom or the liberty to decide for themselves, but we're deciding what they should do.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Chomansky.
May I ask Ms. McKnight to respond to that?
If it's in response to this, please identify yourself, please.
Marilyn McKnight. I'm a mediator with Erickson Mediation Institute. Mr. Chair and committee members, we already have a court rule for post-decree mediation, and it is the court rule that any post-decree matters have to be submitted to mediation before they go to court. We already have that. And in fact, the ones that we receive where people are coming because of that court rule to mediate, most of those are parenting plans that people have never heard of before they've in a divorce originally. And so if we have that court rule, why can't we have a law that just says that they try to mediate first and do those parenting plans up front? That will cut a lot of court time. It will save them post-decree time as well.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the response to that is quite simple. The court currently will encourage parties to seek out a mediator if they cannot agree going forward. Now, this is post-decree, right? And the whole reason for that is cost and expense, and to continue to empower the parties to say, hey, before you come back in, or if you all cannot talk and if you cannot agree, then we say before you come back in court that you go to some mediation, you go to someone, and it doesn't have to be a trained mediator.
Yeah,
it could be
does.
Your pastor. It could be anyone
actually,
who's in
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
It could be just a person who the parties can sit down and talk over this issue. What's the guiding principle? The guiding principle is to make sure parties or families are empowered so that they can continue to rear their children and make sure they're talking to each other, and also to make sure that we're controlling cost and expense, to come back in court, to file a notice of motion in motion, to serve all the parties, to drag lawyers back in is very costly. But it is something that we encourage them to do, even post-decree, but we do not mandate that they should do mediation as the form of alternative dispute resolution on the front end of the equation.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Just briefly. Ms. McKnight.
That's exactly my point, is that if they did that at the beginning of their divorce, they probably wouldn't have any post-decree matters regarding the parenting of their children. That's the whole point. Thank
Representative
you.
Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, do you have any empirical data in order to support what you just said?
There is, and I actually gave you a lot of research last time that was data based on court-ordered, based on custody disputes that were submitted to the court, and then a control group that was randomly chosen and a group that had to mediate. And yes, that study was very, very clear, but the studies ever since 1983, and if you want to look up Surviving the Breakup, I cited all of that last time I was here. Many, many studies showing that mediation works extremely well. People are well satisfied, and it decreases returns to court. It is out there all over. And I will send you that if you wish.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Champ.
I would like that information because there is also empirical data that seems to suggest when parties are empowered, and it's the whole notion of parties being empowered and agreeing as opposed to the process used by which to get to that desired outcome.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Erickson and the rest of the mediators, listen carefully because I may be trying to elicit supporting testimony. On the one hand, we've got mediators testifying for a mandatory mediation bill that sounds like a jobs bill. Secondly, on the other side, I heard testimony from you, Mr. Erickson, that mediation would ease the burden on the courts. I guess I care more about easing the burden on the parties and the children so that there's a healthy parent-child relationship that endures the entire process. Tell me this, in one word or less, is once you've gone to an early neutral evaluation and you've started a contested custody case, and you wind up at the E&E, and through for whatever reason, you sign off on a plan that gives the other side custody temporarily, and you structured or limited visitation. You get home, think better of it. Is it easy or is it difficult to back out of that E&E order?
Mr. Erickson.
Easy or difficult?
I'll try to make it brief.
Mr. Erickson?
From the attorneys I talk to who have difficulty with the E&E process, their concern is that even before any order or temporary hearing is entered, just by going to the E&E process, the parties are forced to begin being locked into positions, and they engage in positional bargaining. When they go to mediation, they are asked to not use terms like custody or visitation. They're asked to use terms about parenting in the future. They're asked to work a complex problem.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Erickson, you favor mandatory mediation so as to not have parties walking away from the E&E feeling locked in to an agreement. Is that what I'm hearring you say?
Well, there's two different processes, and the one process is an adjudicative process, and once the locomotive starts down the track and the parties are engaged in an adjudicative process of evidence as to who's a better or worse parent or whose schedule should prevail, somebody else is deciding for them, and it's hard to get them back on track.
Mr. Chairman,
Smith.
Mr. Erickson, and anyone else, can a simple phone call to one's attorney back one out of an E&E order or proceeding or recommended order?
Mr. Erickson.
I do not know the answer to that.
Mr. Hattie, please use the microphone if you could. Thank you.
Until it's signed by a judge, it's not official. Although the parties may have agreed, it still has to be decreed by the court.
Mr. Chairman, what's the average period of time between signing by the parties and the judge countersigning? 1 hour, 1 day, 1 week, what is it?
Mr. Hattie.
Thank you. It's not going to happen until the parties return to court with either an agreed, stipulated marital termination agreement that includes a family parenting plan, or it's forced to go to court to be resolved by the court. That's when it will be ultimately signed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Smith. Representative Szymanski, do you have other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have a couple in opposition to this bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Szymanski.
I know we've probably exceeded our time limit on this bill, but I would ask the committee's consideration that we discuss the judiciary components of the bill and not all of the civil law matters that will be taken up in the next committee.
Okay, thank you, Representative Szymanski. Before we discuss or have our testimony in opposition, we do still have an amendment before us. And is there further discussion on the amendment? That's the A4 amendment. Okay, all those in favor of adopting the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Szymanski, or Representative Szymanski. Those that wish to testify against, we have the amendment is passed. We have a Mr. Kennedy. And on deck is Mr. Dittbrenner. Welcome, Mr. Kennedy. Could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Bruce Kennedy. I'm an attorney and mediator and early neutral evaluator in Roseville, Minnesota, and I am the legislative chair for the family law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association.
Welcome, Mr. Kennedy, and what is your testimony?
Thank you. The courts have a Rule 114 that they created that has various alternative dispute resolution processes that can be used by parties to resolve disputes. And that rule has been around quite a while, and it has what Mr. Erickson referred to as a smorgasbord of different processes that people are allowed to choose. One of those processes is mediation. Another one is early neutral evaluation. Early neutral evaluation is something that's been used more commonly in the last few years, and there are some mediators, a segment of the population of mediators, who think that early neutral evaluation should take a back seat to mediation. And they're entitled to their opinion, but we don't feel, and we don't think the judiciary feels, that that priority should be established in legislation. This is something that the judges and the parties and their attorneys should be able to work out, and they should be able to choose the process that works best for them. And certainly if those who feel that mediation should precede early neutral evaluation, they should certainly try to persuade the judiciary of that. They should talk to lawyers and talk to judges and so forth and try to convince them that that's the way it should be, but we don't feel it should be something that is in legislation. I should add that in some areas of the state, there are no mediators in some counties. Or I was just told that for Coochaching County, the closest mediator would be in St. Cloud, which is many miles away. It's going to be kind of difficult for some folks to hurriedly have a mediation session within 30 days after starting a dissolution in those circumstances. That's basically what I want to say.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Mr. Michael Ditburner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Ditburner. I am the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. I also happen to be the legislative chair of the Minnesota chapter of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts. The Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers is composed of lawyers that practice family law statewide throughout the state of Minnesota. The Minnesota chapter of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts is an interdisciplinary organization composed not just of attorneys, but also mediators, therapists, and judicial officers throughout the state of Minnesota. Getting to the issue of this particular legislation, I think that those who would impact upon a judicial procedure have a heavy burden of proof in demonstrating the need for legislation doing that, especially considering separation of powers issues and the fact that the legislative branch is a distinct branch from the judicial branch. I'm not talking about substantive law, which the legislature has the right to change and modify from time to time. But there actually is empirical evidence out there regarding the success of the early neutral evaluation program, and it can be found on the Minnesota Judicial Branch website. It's called ECM/ENE Initiative, Early Case Management, Early Neutral Evaluation Pilot. This is the final report to the State Justice Institute, dated October 15, 2010. And it really has been an unqualified success. It has reduced the amount of trials. It has reduced the length that it takes to finish a case by cutting down the number of months. And people have found it to be a very, very good process that helps take these cases and stop them from being litigated. And why in the world we would monkey with that by having legislation that requires parties to mediate parenting plans within 30 days of the date of filing and which would prevent, I think that's the last provision of the bill, the court must order the parties to participate in mediation before the court may order the parties to participate in early neutral evaluation unless one of the exceptions apply. Why would we monkey with success? I just don't understand that, and neither do the members of the organizations that I represent. Furthermore, I mean, a lot of people that do mediation also do early neutral evaluations. They have to be people that are qualified to act in alternative dispute resolution. They're often taking a haircut from the fees that they would usually charge parties in private cases, depending upon the combined income of the parties. And in the case of social early neutral evaluations, according to this report, the fees are quite low. If you have a combined parental income of $60,000, you pay nothing for that early neutral evaluation that is supposed to deal with custody and parenting time issues. And it goes all the way up to those people earning $100,000 and above having to pay a combined total of $500. So why would these people go to a mediator and pay a higher hourly rate when they can have their cases resolved through this type of process? I should also note, too, that I don't understand why people who have already mediated prior to filing their petition for dissolution so should now all of a sudden be forced to go through 2 hours of mediation. I also don't understand why people who may not be ready for mediation yet have to be forced to go to mediation. There's another bill that's going through the state legislature, House File 1135, that would require parenting education. And I think that there's something to be said for people going through the process of parenting education before they go to mediation so as to ensure that the mediation has a greater chance of success. But a lot of these cases are being triaged by the court at the time of the initial case management conference, which often occurs about 3 weeks after filing. And for example, in Hennepin County, they try to do that. Maybe sometimes in other counties it's later than that. But the success is there. And the other problem when we're talking about the issue of parenting plans is that the concept of parenting plan is a rather nebulous concept. It means different things to different people. And I view parenting plans as a good option in the arsenal of different ways to resolve a custody and parenting time model. But I don't think that it's the be-all, end-all of everything. There's three things that a parenting plan has to include. That's a schedule of each time each parent spends with a child, a designation of decision-making responsibilities, and a method of dispute resolution. Now, I've often resolved a case that involves parenting time matters, but I haven't called it a parenting plan, even though it has these components in it. And so when you're mandating people to do a parenting plan, a concept that's not really defined that clearly by statute, I think that you might be injecting a little bit of confusion for people, especially those people that aren't represented by counsel that have no idea of this thing of what you're talking about. And it's going to be those people, I'm assuming, that are going to be the large part, the people that are trying to be steered to mediation of parenting plans. If you view parenting plans, on the other hand, as meaning a situation where you're using alternative terms instead of custody, it may be that, I mean, at least myself, I'm finding that I'm using them less and less as time goes by, just simply because I have more and more cases in which we're agreeing to joint physical custody, albeit maybe not at 50-50 parenting time, but the parties are comfortable agreeing to that. They're comfortable with agreeing to joint legal custody. And so in those cases, you know, there's really no need to call it a parenting plan. I mean, you have a parenting time scheduled. You're agreeing that the people can go to mediation if things in the future don't work out. And by calling it joint legal custody, you're basically dealing with the decision-making responsibilities components. So parenting plans were passed a long time ago, prior to the mid part of last decade when we passed the income share statute, and we also passed the statute that did away with the presumption in favor of the sole physical custodian being presumed to move children out of state. And since then, people really haven't been as having many problems with the concept of just agreeing to joint physical custody, even when they may not have a 50-50 type of parenting time arrangement, even when it might be a 70-30 arrangement or something like that. And it's because there's less to worry about, you know. So I really think that this legislation is solving a problem that doesn't exist, and I really wish the proponents had actually talked to the judiciary and got their input about the legislation prior to proposing this, because the fact of the matter is I fear that it impacts negatively on the judiciary's ability to triage these cases and to resolve them through the early case management process and the early neutral evaluation process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ditburner. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Do you know of any other process through the court process where once someone's already hired a lawyer, you mandate them to go to a process without their lawyer?
I'm not sure of mandating them to go to a process without a lawyer. I will tell you this, there's another facet of the program in Hennepin County of which you should be aware, and that's limited scope representation. And that's where people agree, myself included, to represent somebody for free, pro bono, who is a pro se party who is going through a contested custody and parenting time proceeding, and they're going to an early neutral evaluation, and you're just agreeing to represent them for the process of going through that evaluation and helping them try to settle that case. That has been also a great success in Hennepin County. I think there's about 50 to 100 attorneys that have agreed to do that for people. And that has really, I think, helped to increase the rate at which these cases are settled in that process. So again, I'm saying, please don't monkey with this process. I think there should be some respect for separation of powers here and how the judiciary is processing these cases. It's really unnecessary to do this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the reason why I asked the question is because what this bill is doing is saying you should go to mediation, and they're saying without your lawyer. I mean, that's what all the testimony was. And so I'm curious as to if we've ever mandated that people go and do a process without their lawyer once they've already hired their lawyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I'm not sure that we've done that. I would tend to agree with that.
Thank you. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering where this bill came from. Did it come from Representative Anderson? Where did this come from? Sometimes that tells us what its intent is.
Representative Chemanski.
Mr. Chairman, if I may answer that question, Representative Lane. I believe the mediating organization, as a group, brought the bill forward. Representative Anderson is a member of that group, and consequently she asked me to be the chief author of this bill. So that she would not have a conflict of interest within this bill.
Representative Lane.
Okay, that's very interesting. So all the testimony we've had that this might be, as Mr. Smith said, a jobs bill, and that it is layering on top of what we already have, and I think the current testifier made it very clear that it is working. So sometimes it seems like when something is working, the system is shifting, and something is working, somebody experiences that and said, ooh, this is good, let's mandate it this particular way. And then, as you say, it just throws a monkey wrench into what is already going very nicely and increasing and shifting the system very nicely. I think that you're right, and let the judiciary triage it and let this go forth and grow in a way that I've seen in the system of doing divorce. It has changed dramatically over the last couple decades, and we don't need to mandate another layer on top of what is already working.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to add that I first of all, I talked to some of the judiciary in my district, and they were uniformly against this. And explain to me some of what I have heard this morning, that there are processes in place, that parties are given a menu of options, and in Olmsted County that has been working very well, that they have the initial case management conference, they talk with the parties, people are given a good explanation, they are allowed to choose what works best for them, and that in my particular county, as I said before, where we have a lot of people with different ethnic backgrounds, that sometimes mediation is not the best choice for in a certain situation. And so I want to make that clear. I view this as a mandate. This bill is a mandate. So those of you who don't like mandates, if you vote for this bill, you are enacting a mandate on the courts for something that people now have the ability to choose. You are taking that away and instead giving them a mandate where none is necessary. And I think this is important enough, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to have a roll call on the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Is there any more testimony, either for or against House File 2531? Further discussion on the Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, since the roll call has been asked for, I am going to vote for the bill, but I want the record to reflect my personal position. That is, I consider both E&Es and mediation as a form of outsourcing. I wish the judge had the, on the respective case, had the time, financial resources to handle the case from beginning to end without third-party faces popping up all over the place. So I am going to vote. This bill deserves some more airtime on the floor, and I'm going to support it for those reasons.
Mr. Chairman, I need to abstain from the vote. So can I have the record show that I have abstained?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Further discussion? Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman, to answer some of the recent questions, the Amendment A4 that we brought forward today was the result of a conference that Representative Anderson and I had with Judge Redding from Hennepin County Family Courts. The courts also weighed in on this bill. We tried to incorporate some modifications to the bill in this amendment. We're not able to incorporate all of the court's recommendations, but we felt that we did reach compromise in this amendment that's presented today.
Okay, thank you, Representative Szymanski. And would you, Representative Champion?
Mr. Chair, is it appropriate to hear from the courts? I know Nancy Haas is here, and I think it would be important to hear if the court supports this bill or not, especially since we have heard the interjection of Judge Redding.
Anyone wish to further testify? Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. Representative Champion, thank you for your question. From MDJA's perspective, we typically do not get involved in these sorts of policy issues. And so while I know many individual judges have thoughts about this issue, we have not taken a position.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. Representative Szymanski, any final words?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the committee's diligence on this bill. We anticipate a fair vote on it.
Thank you, and would people watch whatever they've got near a microphone? We'd like to hear the motion when Representative Szymanski renews it here.
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 2531, as amended, be recommended to pass the Senate of the Civil Law Committee.
Thank you. Motion's been made and a roll call requested.
Representative Szymanski.
Aye.
Representative Mazerall.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson abstains. Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Cornish.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lesch.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Swazinski.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative Wardlow.
Yes.
House File 2531 passes by a vote of 10 ayes and 5 nays and is referred to civil law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Szymanski. Representative Szymanski, you have another bill before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope we don't have to take as many minutes of testimony on this one. House file, first of all, Mr. Chairman, I move House File 2680 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, thank you, Representative Szymanski. And you have testimony on this?
Yes, we do. Mr. Chairman, I received information on this bill from the Minnesota's Courts Administration, and deals with restricted data and data required for building the jury selection files for the Courts Administration. And with me today is
Janet Marshall,
excuse me.
Okay, welcome, Ms. Marshall. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office.
Welcome, Ms. Marshall.
This bill is here today to correct an error. Presently, when we pick our jury source list, we take information from the Department of Vehicle Services, which is all of Minnesota's driver's license and Minnesota ID cards, and we then merge it with the registered voters list that we get from the Secretary of State. And then we throw out the duplicates, and that makes our jury source list. What we found, when we went to the Secretary of State's office this year to get the information from them, they pointed out that actually the statute that permits them to give us this information was repealed in 2004, and no one realized it. We went back and listened to the legislative history, and there's no mention of it. We actually found someone who worked on it, was part of the Voter Act, found someone who worked on it. They said it wasn't conscious, and what they think happened was that it accidentally got repealed when at the last minute staff was trying to clean up a conference committee report. So we have been getting this information from them since the early 90s, and we would like to continue to get that information.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Any questions for this witness? Representative Lesh.
I just, Mr. Chair, Ms. Marshall, I want to extend on behalf of the legislature our thanks to the courts for breaking the law in order to give us juries.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Anyone else wishing to testify for or against this bill? Okay, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion that House File 2860 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. House File 2680 is passed. House File 2680 is recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, the next bill on our agenda today is House File 358 from Representative Barrett. Yes, Representative Barrett, this bill moved through this committee last year and made it to the House floor, but did not pass. We're bringing it back today to repass it from our committee. Would someone like to move the bill before us? Representative Vogel?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Vogel moves House File 358 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Barrett, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm here to discuss House File 358, which prevents non-cooperation agreements and ordinances within cities in Minnesota. I'll just give you a brief background. I know you heard this bill last year. It was approved through this committee. It got caught up in the process of moving bills between committees, and so I'm back here to have it renewed and passed again. The bill supports federal laws related to illegal immigration, specifically the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which mandates that local officials not restrict the sharing of information about illegal immigration with federal authorities. It also supports Title 8, Section 1373, and Title 8, Section 1644. This bill is not anti-immigrant. Quite the contrary, the bill supports immigration that happens through the current legal process that our country has had in place for hundreds of years to support immigration to the United States. Certainly one thing we can take away from the tragic events of September 11, 2001 is that communication between the different branches of government is critically important for the security of our citizens, and the lack of communication between jurisdictions results in tragedy. Many counties are in this state are spending millions of dollars to improve communication by purchasing 800 megahertz radio devices to be used for better communication in emergencies. Communication is critically important, as we have seen. This bill allows for better communication between the various agencies related to a very important issue in our state. The current situation in our country regarding illegal immigration is confusing enough without having separate policies that collectively further confuse the issue. As other states, such as Georgia, Florida, Arizona, enact laws that support the rights of their citizens and support federal laws, a worry is that the sanctuary that is communicated by local policies will actually attract more people to our state, which places a tremendous burden on Minnesota. Studies suggest that the total cost of illegal immigration in our country is over $100 billion. Because of the clandestine nature of the issue, it's really hard to know. Could be more, could be less. There are costs related to education, human services, criminal justice. These costs are real. As we know, last year we had a $5 billion budget deficit, and we are having trouble meeting the needs of citizens of our state. Department of Justice data says that 17% of those people incarcerated in federal prisons are Mexican citizens. Other stats show 27% of people incarcerated are not legal citizens of our country. About 50% of the offenses committed are drug-related. Meth is imported to the United States over the borders, mostly our southern borders, as are other drugs. There was a big arrest last week, I believe, or the week before in Minneapolis regarding a big meth ring. Drug trafficking is an important and huge cost to our country, both in terms of people and in terms of resources. The cost of drug use and abuse in our country is over $1 billion a year. We have many good prevention treatment programs. One thing we do not have is a good way to prevent illegal drugs from coming into our country. Drug use and abuse in our country is out of control. It's affecting people of all races, ages, genders. Not doing everything possible to support our federal laws related to illegal immigration has a profound effect on this issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barrett. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Barrett, there's many, many problems with this bill, from removing local control to putting in tremendous burden in terms of an unfunded local mandate on local government. But a couple questions even before that is there a Senate companion to this bill?
Representative Johnson, there is a Senate companion, whether it's been dropped yet or not, I'm not sure. But there, if there isn't now, there will be very shortly.
I mean, we're a week, right on deadline week, and I looked on the website before I came, and I didn't see any Senate companion. It just seems odd that we'd be even pursuing this without any movement on the Senate side.
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, as I said, if there's not one now, there will be very shortly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, is there a fiscal note somewhere in this pile, too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is a fiscal note. I think that was one of the issues with the bill last year, is it didn't have a fiscal note because one of the agencies of the executive branch didn't complete their task. I believe it was a judicial part that was missing. The fiscal note came through a couple days ago, and it showed a zero cost.
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't had a chance to review the fiscal note because I hadn't received it yet, but given the fact that this bill creates two new causes of action, it clearly has to have an impact on the judiciary, not to mention the number of lawsuits that could easily occur as a result of people filing lawsuits based on the restriction of providing data to the government feeling that they were not treated properly, or lawsuits from civil rights actions for being unfairly profiled. So I see all sorts of problems with this bill. Just since we're a judiciary committee, from the judiciary perspective, it's going to create more burdens for the courts. And if that's not reflected in the fiscal note, I guess that doesn't say much about the fiscal note, because there certainly are problems in that regard. But that's all I have to say right now. It's the bill's a huge problem for a variety of reasons. We've gone through that in public safety in terms of what its intent is and what its impact is to our local governments. And with that, I'll pass right now, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions for Representative Barrett. Representative Barrett, my other job, I work as a city attorney, and I have people come through court once in a while, defendants or other folks who may or may not have legal status in the United States. If I decided that I was going to ensure that we reduce this number, and say I was up in court and we were on the record, I had a caseload, and I came across somebody who I thought, based on what I saw, was probably not here legally, and I decided to go downstairs and make a call to the federal government to see if they're doing anything about this, and my supervisor said, Mr. Lesh, what are you doing? You're supposed to be in court trying cases. Why are you down here on the phone calling the federal government about an immigration case? And I said, well, can't do nothing to stop me. I got a law that says I can do this. Would I be right on that? Could my supervisor do anything to prevent me from taking that action as a citizen?
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I think your supervisor would have to conform to the law that we have in front of us, House File 358, if it became law. And if denying you that right would break this section of the law, then I guess they would be breaking the law.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Barrett. I could go down a list of similar scenarios, not just city attorney, but if I was a pothole filler and I saw someone whose house I thought it was full of illegals, and I decided to drive on down to the district office and make a call on the federal government, supervisor asked, what are you doing? Go out and fill your potholes. Same thing would be true. If I was a parks worker and decided I was going to mark down license plates of individuals who I thought were in the park and weren't there legally, our darn thing my supervisor could do about it after that. That is what people are talking about when they're talking about an unfunded local mandate. And with the cuts to local government aid, including law enforcement and these agencies, over the course of the past 8 years, Representative Barrett, I understand what you're trying to do, but it's a blunt force object that has drastic impacts on local government at precisely the time we cannot afford those ongoing burdens on local government to our police, our fire, our prosecutors. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Barrett.
No, I guess in reply to that, I guess I would say what I consider a benefit of this bill, if it becomes law, is what it does to prevent illegal immigration from coming to our state, and specifically Minneapolis, St. Paul, but other cities as well. When you have a huge resource of people on our border trying to protect our border, trying to protect people from not coming in illegally, and then once they get past that, I see this big billboard saying, come to Minnesota because we will provide sanctuary. What I would like to do is prevent these costs, reduce costs of illegal immigration in our state. So I believe, I respect your opinion on that. I believe on the opposite side, it will actually reduce costs in Minnesota because it will act to remove a billboard that specifically says, come to Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Barrett. We have two more questions from members. I would remind members that we do have two more bills that will be heard this morning. We have testifiers here that could be with us this morning. We don't want to delay their schedule. So, Representative Liebling, your question, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Barrett. I don't think we have any billboard. I don't think there's any evidence that we're any magnet for undocumented people any more than any other state that has or doesn't have this kind of a law. But I really just raised my hand to point out the hypocrisy of this kind of a bill, because members, you know, federal law is federal law, and we shouldn't pick and choose which ones we want to follow. But your caucus does just that on health care law all the time. We have a constant refrain about how we're not going to follow it. It's not constitutional, you know, and the law is the law. And here we're saying not only are we going to, frankly, I think local governments do follow the law, and I think that this just gives a wrong perception about what Minneapolis and St. Paul do, and in fact Rochester does, and that is they do follow the law. They do share this information. They just don't make it their top priority. They make local policing their top priority, and then they do this when it becomes relevant. That's what they do in Rochester. When a person's immigration status is relevant to what's going on, they do ask about it. They do convey the information. And to pass a law like this basically says, we're going to make you prioritize that over all your other functions. Another mandate on local governments from the party that says we don't like mandates, and a picking and choosing of which laws we think we're going to follow and which laws are important. And I just think that's absurd. I think this is just a message bill that doesn't help solve a problem, which we all agree there is a problem, but this is not the way to solve it. I don't think there's any evidence that this solves it. All this does is put a mandate on local governments and put more costs on them and not allow them to prioritize their work. And Representative Barrett, to think that, you know, you or you, so some people care about this issue and other people don't, to say that our local authorities, that the local police in my community don't care about this, and that you have to tell them how they should handle it, I think that's just absurd.
Representative Barrett, any reply?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, nowhere did I say that no local police don't care. They care deeply. I think we all care deeply. We just have maybe a difference of opinion on the issue. So let the record show that in no way did I ever or would I ever say that local police don't care.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, would you pull your mic toward you?
Sure. You. And I'll even lean in.
All right.
As we debated this bill last time, I made this same statement. This isn't just about law enforcement being able to investigate someone's immigration status. Any state employee. So I, as a state representative, or my staff, can investigate anyone's immigration status. And I commented in committee the last time we heard this bill. For example, Representative McDonald kind of talks like a leprechaun. So if I wanted to investigate his immigration status, I could. I said that in committee. Okay. That is what this bill says. It's very clear.
I just didn't want to impute any reference to another member of the legislature.
Well, I didn't impute his motives.
Okay.
I was just commenting about the way he talks.
I'm referring to
Representative McDonald. So he laughed about it the last time we talked about it. So I want to make it really, really clear. You're not saying that law enforcement, when someone is committing a crime, should investigate someone's immigration status. You're saying any state employee or local unit of government employee at any time, whether it's their job or not, can investigate anybody's immigration status. So if I want to investigate anybody who testifies immigration status, I can. And there's nothing that says I can't. And it actually says that no one can stop me from doing it, because I happen to work for the state. So if we have people who are filling the potholes, or we have people who are working in the parks, or we have people who want to investigate others, even if they're behaving legally, this bill says you can do it. And so let me tell you, if this becomes law, one of the first things that's going to happen is you're going to see a bunch of state employees investigating people they don't like, or people they disagree with. and there's not a thing anybody can do about it. It would be a very different discussion if you were talking about people who were not law-abiding, people who were breaking the law, people who were doing things that were illegal. That would be a very different discussion, but that's not what this bill says.
Representative Barrett?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the... I understand your point of view. I think as you look at the definition of sanctuary cities throughout the country and in our state, you'll find slightly different wording in the city statutes or city communication that describes themselves as sanctuary cities. What you will find generically or generally is a statute that says something like no worker of the city can bring an action or can be involved in the dissemination of a person's legality. And so what the bill here, what the drafting of that language does is counters that. It counters what sanctuary cities, what descriptions, general descriptions of sanctuary cities currently communicates.
Mr. Chair, but that's not...
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But that's not what this bill says. That's not what it says, and that's not what it does. This is much more expansive than what you're testifying to. This gives anyone who happens to work for a governmental unit, no matter what the governmental unit is. I think our municipal liquor store now is a governmental unit, right, because they are city employees who happen to run the liquor store. There is nothing keeping any employee from investigating anyone's status. That's what this bill says. So we're not talking about people who are breaking the law. We're talking about regular citizens being investigated by somebody while the state or the local unit of government, while taxpayers are paying their salary. I thought we wanted our employees to do the job that we hire them to do, not to go out on a vigil ante hunt investigating everyone's immigration status, no matter what they look like. Because this doesn't say that you have to suspect that they're illegal. Doesn't have to say you suspect they're undocumented. It says anybody can investigate anybody's immigration status. So can I, as an employee, walk up to you and say, can I please see your immigration status papers? Can I see your birth certificate to prove that you're really born here? I mean, I'm not sure. But it says my employer can't keep me from doing that. I don't think that's what you're testifying to.
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative, understand your point. I disagree with your point. I think the intent of the bill here is to allow people whose jobs and duties require them to uphold the safety of our state and our cities to do their jobs. And so while you're painting a scenario of which a clerk in some office building somewhere could see someone and have an issue and go down a route that you've just described, I don't believe that will happen. I think a lot of laws, bills come through this committee and other committees in which there is some speculation of something drastic happening, and many times that drastic happening never happens. And so I see your scenarios may be one of those issues in which you're seeing one picture happening, I'm seeing another one. I'm seeing our law enforcement personnel being able to do their jobs without being hampered by city ordinances that conflict with our federal laws.
Okay. Again, members, we do have other people here to testify on other bills. Representative Hillstrom, short.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think this is a really important issue, and I don't know if you're going to ask if anyone in the audience wants to testify against it, but I think it has been the policy of this state that when people break the law in our state, even if there are illegals, that we want them to suffer the punishment in our state before we send them to wherever it is that they're going to go. Right? If they're breaking the law, they commit a crime, we want them to do their time in our jail, in our prisons, before the next step happens. What you're saying here is that, again, people should investigate other people's statuses and maybe get them deported or kicked out even before they answer for whatever crime it is that you're alleging they might have committed. because basically what you said is anybody who's undocumented is involved with doing drugs and dealing drugs. I mean, that was kind of your testimony. And so I just don't necessarily think that we want to be doing that before we, if you think they're all criminals, that they should be deported before they suffer the consequence of their actions.
Representative Barrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I did not say at all that everyone who is an illegal immigrant is doing drugs. Never said that at all. What I said was that illegal drugs is a huge problem in our country. I did say that I think 17 to 20% of people in our jails are illegal immigrants. I referenced another study that said 27% of people incarcerated are not legal citizens. And half of the people in jails are related to drug offenses. Drug issues are a huge problem in our country. But I did not say at all that illegal immigrants, 100%, are drug dealers. I didn't say that.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I do take issue, Representative Barrett, with your use of the term sanctuary city, because I think that's strictly a pejorative term geared for intent other than anything having to do with public safety. In fact, the police have authority currently, and they do, in fact, arrest criminals regardless of immigration status, and they do work with Department of Homeland Security in St. Paul to deal with criminal matters, and to suggest otherwise is simply wrong. And when I look, secondly, when I look at this fiscal note here, I got information from the City of St. Paul for the upcoming 2 years, they would say the cost to their local government would be around $8.1 million to enforce the kind of legislation you're suggesting here. So the fiscal impact is obvious. And if so, in addition to undermining public safety, it's going to cost local governments millions of dollars. It just makes absolutely no sense.
Representative Barrett.
I haven't seen, Mr. Chair, Representative, I haven't seen that information. I'll take you at your word that it will cost $8.1 million. I'd have to look at the details to really understand that for my own benefit. But would be happy to.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly, to the testifier, it's sort of consistent with what Representative Hillstrom has so eloquently outlined. She talks about this bill being very broad and refers to, you know, all public employees. And when you begin to take that to its logical deductive end, this opens up local governments, school districts, you know, even universities to a potential slew of lawsuits. So I'm curious to understand, you know, when you say on line 1.20 as well as line 2.16, it talks about non-cooperating. So can you describe for me and talk a little more about those provisions and how potentially an organization or someone could be deemed a non-cooperating entity?
Representative Barry.
Well, I think it's pretty, Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I think it's fairly clear in my mind what non-cooperating means. It means you're not cooperating with other jurisdictions about a particular legal matter. And so we can talk about particular cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, others, Austin, or we can just say, generally speaking, that any city in our state is required to cooperate, which I think is the intent of the bill here and the intent of my opening testimony when we talked about different areas of government beneficial when they work together. And so this would allow various levels of government to work together for the benefit of the people.
Representative Champion.
Follow up. So that sort of, you know, lands upon my challenge with this bill is your response is you are clear in your mind what it means, but once we put legislation or in place and something becomes law, now this has to be interpreted by an ordinary person. What do they see as an entity not cooperating? And that opens us up to clearly defining what that means. That opens us up to, you know, increased litigation coming through the doors, because what it does is that this bill clearly says that that a person lawfully domiciled in this state may bring a private right right of action. So help me understand how what you're thinking in your mind is going to be clearly communicated to those who are ordinary citizens so that they can decide or determine if they, in fact, have a right to sue under this bill.
Representative Barry.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I think if we look at the laws in our state, we know that laws come from bills that come from us, then get signed into law by the governor, then get interpreted by the courts. And I think with many laws, some bills are interpreted. A lot of them are. Sometimes laws are pretty clear. You might have a clear picture of a particular law. I might have a clear picture of another law. But they get interpreted over time. And so this would be no different than any other bill that becomes a law that needs to be interpreted by the judicial branch when rights of action come to them. No different than any other thing that they're used to. That's why we have a judicial branch to go through complaints and issues and understand clearly what the intent of the law is.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Barrett. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Barrett, I just want to thank you for your great bill. It's only eclipsed by the Castle Doctrine this year. It's the only thing with this better.
High praise indeed.
But as the DFL rails on it and says, talks about a fiscal note, that fiscal note is preposterous. It comes from a city or group that doesn't like the bill, and so they got to assail it with a huge fiscal note and scare everybody. That's what we've been used to all year with fiscal notes. We find an agency doesn't like a bill, they put a great big fiscal note on it. And the word investigate, I don't see that in here where you're mandated to investigate anyway. This is permissive. It just says that they're not going to seal you. If you want to turn somebody in for being an illegal alien and you see some abuse going on, you can, that the government can't restrict you. So anyway, a lot of these claims just don't have any substance behind them, and thank you very much for your bill.
You're welcome.
Representative Barrett. Okay. Hearing no other, or by the way, is there anyone in the, oh, okay, we are not taking testimony on this bill. So, Representative Smith?
No.
Okay. All right. Representative Vogel removes his motion that House File 358 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
The bill is passed. All right. We have two more bills on our agenda today, but we're almost out of time. Representative Smith, would you like to move to the testifiers table? You may have one witness that would like to testify on one of these bills. If that witness would come forward today.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Smith, which bill would you like to do first?
Let's do House File 876, Mr. Chairman, and if the committee agreed to ask no questions, engage no discussion, and if the audience agreed to no testimony, we can do both bills in the next 2 minutes.
All right, Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
Short of that, I'll move House File 876. And let's see what we can do here. This, Mr. Chairman, this bill was actually heard in this committee, was passed through this committee, passed the floor of the House last year. It was part of the omnibus crime bill, and it was dropped in committee due to some trouble with the Senate. At any rate, the bottom line is this. It's in 1986, Minnesota changed its law to essentially open up delinquency cases for 16 and 17-year-olds charged with any felony. It was part of a national trend. As a result, however, we've got 2,000 to 3,000 felony-level delinquency petitions filed every year. And later, when the young people seek work, try to get their life back on track, or employment, or housing, they'll often be denied, sometimes not even knowing that it's their juvenile record. This situation is contrary to rehabilitative purposes of our public juvenile justice system. There's a need, Mr. Chairman and members, for holding kids accountable so that they can learn from their mistakes. Sometimes their parents encourage them to cooperate, turn themselves in, not knowing that the record's going to follow them. Their youthful mistakes should not hold them back for the rest of their lives. And if we can have testimony for
Representative Smith, is there a DE2 amendment to this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there is. I'll move the DE2 amendment and ask the testifier to explain.
All right. The Representative Smith moves the DE1-2 amendment to House File 876. Is there any discussion before we adopt that amendment for further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Smith, proceed. Do you have a testifier with you, Representative Smith?
I'd like him to take about a half a minute to explain DE2 as amended.
All right. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm with the Council on Crime and Justice, a Minneapolis-based nonprofit organization. Just being real quick on the amendment, when we first started looking at this issue, there were some concerns about making sure that more violent, serious offenses remain publicly available. And this amendment addresses that by making EJJ proceedings automatically public. And just real quickly, I know you've heard about EJJ before, but I think it's helpful to quickly review what creates an EJJ case. A case would go to EJJ if a certification hearing was held and the court designated the proceeding EJJ, extended jurisdiction juvenile, or the child is alleged to have committed an offense for which the sentencing guidelines and applicable statutes presume a commitment to prison, or to have committed any felony in which the child allegedly used a firearm. Or the prosecutor requested that the proceeding be designated an EJJ prosecution. A hearing was held and the court designated it EJJ. So again, under current law, if you're 16, 17-year-old charged with any felony level offense, that's a public hearing and the ensuing records are public. Even if the charges are later dismissed or reduced, that's going to be a public record that's going to follow that child into the future. The exception now would be EJJ cases, of course, certification hearings. One couple things I'd like to note, victims will still have access to the hearings under other statutes, and the records would maintain their current availability for Department of Human Services background studies, corrections, law enforcement, schools, parents, and all positions requiring a background check to work with children. This change will give the judges the discretion to decide if an offense is serious or violent enough to make it public. Otherwise, for the 16, 17-year-old felony delinquency proceedings, it would remain private. The intent is to keep is to allow the juvenile to seek employment and housing and other opportunities in the future when they remain law-abiding. Just want to quickly note the support on this. This is part of the Council's agenda, the Minnesota Second Chance Coalition's agenda, the Minnesota Corrections Association legislative agenda. It's also supported by the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, the Minnesota Association of Community Probation Officers, and the Minnesota Juvenile Detention Association. Addressing the issue as part of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Hazy. We have expired our committee time for this morning, but if there is anyone else that needs to testify on this bill that cannot be with us at a later date, please step forward and give us your brief remarks on this bill. I would remind the committee that we are nearing our first deadline at the end of the week. The committee will be meeting Thursday morning, and we have reserved committee space for Thursday evening if we do not complete our agenda on Thursday morning. So, good morning, sir. Welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Arneson. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney and the manager of our Juvenile Prosecution Division. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee, of which I'm a member, and also on behalf of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm here speaking in opposition to House File 876. In our view, current law maintains the appropriate balance between the public's right to know about serious juvenile crime and how its juvenile justice system is handling these cases, while also protecting the confidentiality interests of younger and less serious juvenile offenders. Concerns have been raised about the potential unfair consequences to juveniles and their records in certain circumstances, and those, in our view, are more properly addressed by the expungement laws as they currently exist. Instead of closing down the juvenile justice system further, current law allows some light to be shed on the juvenile justice system. This bill creates a presumption of secrecy for an additional class of serious offenses. Additionally, it will be difficult to have these decisions made on a case-by-case basis and will lead to disparity in treatment of these cases, jurisdiction by jurisdiction. The law leaves open a number of questions as to how it should be enforced or put into effect. Who is supposed to raise this issue? Is it the judge? Is it a community member, a specific victim, police, the prosecutor, the judge? This practice will likely raise very widely county by county. When does it get raised? Before the case gets to court, after the case is closed? The standards for when the hearing will vary, when the hearings will vary, will be public jurisdiction by jurisdiction. The bill does not provide guidance as to how the court is supposed to weigh the potential benefit to public safety versus the potential consequence for the child due to the public record. In our view, the intrinsic value of openness, the good that we see in holding our government and our elected officials, including judges and prosecutors, accountable, is important in the more serious cases in the juvenile justice system. In most instances, a member of the press or the community is not going to be sitting in the courtroom, but the actions of everyone in the courtroom will be subject to scrutiny and are under the current law, and that's a good thing. We all operate better in the sunlight, and it makes our courts function better. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I would remind the committee that this bill will be laid over and taken up and again at a later time. Representative Hillstrom, did you have a comment for this witness? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the witness, I used to do some expungement hearings, but I'm wondering, has something changed based on your testimony that you felt that the expungement process was an adequate remedy to deal with the cases that were appropriate to mask those from public view? Can now the court seal juvenile records from the executive branch records in cases of juveniles?
The Court of Appeal, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, in a recent case of the Court of Appeals in re JJP, the Court of Appeals interpreted the Minnesota Statute 260B-198, the disposition provision of the Juvenile Code, to allow a broad range of expungement, including of executive branch records. That case is currently, it has been petitioned for review to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So all of juvenile expungement really is up in the air. My view would be to address any concerns related to this area in relation to expungement, in relation to what do we allow employers to consider, what do we allow people who are providing housing to consider in looking at a juvenile, a 16, 17-year-old juvenile's felony case.
Okay.
So, well, to answer your question more specifically, yes, there was a recent case of the Court of Appeals, and its current status is pending. But I think it's likely to affect what the law is in Minnesota.
Okay. Representative Rush,
that seems to me the $67,000 question, Mr. Chair. As long as those are disclosed, that you know, having an expungement, that and $2 will get you a latte at Starbucks. But until then, I want to make sure that I know that the courts can reasonably mask those.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chairman, do you intend
Mr.
to resume?
Representative Smith,
do you intend to resume testimony in this bill Thursday morning?
That will be determined at future date time. Thank you, Representative Smith. Members of the committee, thank you for your diligence today. We have exceeded our allotted time. The committee will meet again Thursday morning, March 15th, 8:15 a.m. With that, we are adjourned.